Good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin this evening by the recitation of the Heart Sutra in Tibetan. Om ji ji nub jan zam pe ma ge zar dom bo la yam sen cho ge ng dro ne pe ma ju ne she so da kor do kan dro ma bo kor ji ji je so chin je lob ji she so sen kor pe ma se de ho de ne nam da kun ja re be she zen zen cho be bo ble rab dro wa jur me den de ne lo yon zen do je zen la so wa de lhab sum nam da ma de ji de me sa me ne lo gun ju ra na ju ra cho kal de ku ji ra min ze cha ba la jan ce sha bla so wa de nam da ma la sa be me ba le be me don zo do do la ma yi che zo ri ji se zo che nam ba ra je we pa wa ra so wa de ja ga ra ke do ba ga wa te prajna Bhikkhu do chom den de ma she rab je parul do chimbe nyam bo bam bo je go te ge da gi to ba du je na chom den de cha bo kha cha ge pum bo ge long gi gun den cham bo da chang ju sem be gun den cham bo da tha ji do sho de de che chom den de sa mo na wa Chuji nam ranji ting yin zin la nyum bari shu so yan te ye tse chan ju semba semba chenpo papa ji rizi wang chu she rab ji paru sami chupa nidla nam bari ta shin pungpo ngapo te ta la yang rang shin ji tongpa nam bari ta tenen san ji ji tu tse dan denpa shari bhu chan ju semba semba chenpo papa ji rizi wang chu la di ke ji Rijibu, Rijinu, Charabji Parul, Do Chimba, Samu, Chupa, Chaparanda, Bande, Chetara, Labara, Tegi, Chim, Heba, Dan, Chanchu, Samba, Samba, Chambu, Papa, Chirisi, Wanchu, Gi, Tsedan, Shara, Dati, Bula, Tegi, Chim, He, So, Sharibu, Rijibu, Ham, Rijibu, Mo, Kala, La, Sherabji Parul, Do Jeparanda Bande, Tetara Nambara Tawara Chate, Pumbo Nabo Teta Jan Ranjin Jin, Tombara Nambara Yanda Parajesu Tawo, So Tomba, Tomba Ni Su, So Sule, Tomba Ni Shema Yin, Tomba Ni Le Jan Su, Shema Yin, No, Te Jindu, Tarwat. Tujedan Nambara Shepa Nam Tongba Ho Sharibu Tedara Chu Tamje Tongba Nide Tsenye Meba Majeba Bagaba Chemam Chemadan Drawa Chewa Meba Kangwa Meba Sharibu De Tawena Tongba Nila Zu Me Tsurwa Me Dushe Me Duje Nam Nambara Shepa Me Mig Me Nawa Me Name Jeb Lu me, ye me, zo me, dra me, tre me, ro, reja me, che me, do, me ge kam me ba ne, hi je kam me, hi je nambare shepe kam je bardo me, mare ba seba me ba ne, kashi me, kashi bardo wa me, te jindu dunga wa dang, kunjung wa dang, goba dang, lam me, ishe me, toba, Mato Bahame Do Sharibu De Tawena Chanju Sembanam Tobam Chiparul Do Chimbala Denji Nete Semla Chiba Mebe Chaba Mede Chinji Loli Shindo Dene Nyangin Linde Parachi Number Tamje Tamje Jan Sherab Chiparul Do Chimbala Dene Lana Meba Yanda Barzo Be Chanju De Tawena Sherabji Parul Do Chimbenga, Rigba Chimbenga, Lana Mebenga, Minyam Bada Nyambenga, Dongal Tamje Rabdur Shivara Jebe, Medun Benan Dembra Shabara Chate, Sherabji Parul Do Chimbenga, Meba, Deyata, Gate Gate, Para, Para Sam Gate Bodhi Swaha, Sharibu, Chanju Samba Samba Chambu, Tedar Sherabji Parul Do Chimba Samola, Habara Chao, Tene Chum Dende Tingin Zendele Shinde, Chanju Samba Samba, Haba Chinrezi, Wanchula, Le So, She Chawa Chin, Le So, Rigibu, Tede Shino Rigibu, Tede Shinde, Chedra Chuji, Tamba Shindu Sherab. samola che paracha te te jin she pa nam chang che so ye rang ho chom den de chi de ke che ka chal ne che dan den ba shara da ti chang jo sem ba tam je dan den be ko ra de da ha dan me dan la ma yin dan che zare che pe chi den ye rang te chom den de che som ba ngam bara to do e kang ge ten jin ra wa ra chung ka ba me ba che Cheba meba da meba, onwa meba, drom meba, tade dhumin dhunji, treba nishi shirdenbe, zobe sanje man, tamba de la chakchalo. Now, as far as the topic goes, one of the most extraordinarily complex and profound topic of the Heart Sutra, and having me to say something about it, I thought was funny enough. But then you want me to finish that in an evening. That's even more, I think, funny, should I say, or extraordinary. But since you put me here, there, let's see what we can do about it. I'm very happy that you all have the text with you, so you can refer to the text also. There are different versions. I have on my table about three different translations. There's the Dharmasri translation, there is Ari's translation, and then there's the Nalanda translation, as well as one translation that you have here from the Rigpa Sangha. Now, all of these are wonderful translations of this very profound text called the Heart Sutra, fondly called the Heart Sutra. Now, in terms of the text itself, and anyone who has some understanding of this Mahayana text will know that it is not a particular study material. It is, the text itself is a part of recitation, not as a prayer though, but more as a reminding, verbal reminder to the practitioner about the quintessence of Buddha Dharma. So in some ways, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, or what is called the Heart Sutra, can also be called the very core of the Buddhist teachings. You know, people these days often, especially newcomers, like to ask, what is Buddha Dharma about? If you hand them a copy of the Prajnaparamita text, that probably is a good answer as to what the Buddhists are trying to do, and if it, upon reading it, if they cannot understand it, because it says about there being no eyes and ears and mouth and nose and so forth. So oftentimes for a new person, of course, as you say in English, it'll go over the top of your head. Then, and they say they didn't understand at all, then you have to say, that's the point, precisely. That's what Buddhism is trying to do. Yeah. Now, why so is because, as I said, it's not particularly a study text, but it is founded upon the concept of the text called the Heart Sutra being based upon Mahabodhisattva or Arya Avalokiteshvara's own deep reflection on the perfection of wisdom. Text itself consists of three sort of main characters: Arya Avalokiteshvara, the one who is responding and upon whom is based the Heart Sutra, the response of whom is the Heart Sutra itself. The protagonist, Shariputra, who is actually the one asking questions. So basically, the Heart Sutra happens to be a dialogue or a question and answer between Shariputra and Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva. Buddha himself is present throughout the text, but one of the most remarkable aspects of Heart Sutra itself also consists of the fact that the Buddha is present, but he doesn't speak, except for the concluding part where he says, excellent, excellent, this is how it is, this is exactly how it is, and sort of affirms that what is being spoken about is absolutely true. Now, the Buddha's silence itself forms the very fundamental, basic principle of what Buddha Dharma is about. Is that, yes, different approaches according to different capacities and potentials of human beings does invade even in what is called Buddhist philosophy, in that it is taught in diverse ways. And those of you who have practiced Buddhism, and this room consists of mainly all practitioners, so you're familiar with what I'm saying. All the different practices, different paths, different philosophies and teachings, all of them are relevant, but like all rivulets collecting into a single ocean, in the same way, all of the diverse aspects of Buddha Dharma gather into the single ocean of silence. Now, not passive silence, but silence is a temporary phrase used for the courage and the insight to go beyond conventional thinking, and particularly within the realm of conventional thinking, assuming that intellectualization serves as the basis of finding answers. So therefore, when we look at Arya Avalokiteshvara, now if you follow the text, the first verse itself, which begins with, thus have I heard, up until the end of the first verse. Now I have a text which has one verse, but probably for you all, in the text that you have. This is for the people with better eyes. Okay. Yes, on page number two. Page number two, third last line. Prajnaparan saw in this way, he saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. That is the pause, what is usually called the first verse. Now, through that first verse, the very sort of the particular aspects or characteristics of the first verse refers to Arya Avalokiteshvara in deep samadhi. And then, therefore, what kind of a deep samadhi or samadhi, or meditation, or introspection. And if one asks, what kind of a samadhi was Arya Avalokiteshvara abiding in? Then in the Mahayana teachings, Madhyamika teachings, one refers to that samadhi or introspection of Avalokiteshvara being reflecting or seeing the very fundamental nature. No, I have many copies of the same text. That's okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Of Arya Avalokiteshvara in introspection, seeing or realizing, recognizing. Now, it's very difficult always when we speak about a subject such as the Heart Sutra to use words such as seeing. You'll have to say, because the English word I have problems with. Seeing, but you'll have to take seeing as a word that is not dependent upon a subject, neither an object. So seeing just as it is. Because if you put subjectiveness to the word seeing, then there's a seer. And then if you put an object, then there's something to see. So without misunderstanding these words as being dependent upon a subject and an object, just giving the freedom of the word to be seeing, then you may use the word seeing. Realizing is another word that we often use in philosophy. But at the same time, realizing has to be without the connotation of it containing a realizer and something to realize. So therefore, samadhi that Avalokiteshvara was in is a sense of awakening, again, without an awaker and something to see so that he becomes awake. But being able to recognize the very fundamental nature as it is, without a projection, without any kind of assumption, but just as it is, the nature of self and the nature of phenomena. Being able to non-distractedly or undistractedly remaining in that recognition is often called Avalokiteshvara, abiding in the samadhi of the perfection of wisdom. So therefore, in the beginning, first verse, it refers to Avalokiteshvara abiding within such a deep reflection, and that reflection is nothing other than awareness of what the fundamental nature of things are, what is the true nature of self, as well as what is the true nature of every arising perceptible phenomena. Being not deviated from that fundamental nature, Avalokiteshvara sat in that sort of introspection or that deep samadhi or reflection. And therefore, what he recognized is often referred to be Prajnaparamita, or what is loosely translated as perfection of wisdom. Now, if you look at the term itself, the full title of the sutra, as I said, it is not particularly a study material. If you want to study Heart Sutra, you have to study Madhyamika, great works of masters, particularly of Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Aryadeva, and so forth. And so Madhyamikan studies, or the study of the views, allows a person to go into different versions of the Prajnaparamita Sutra. This is the shortest of the sutras. Some are more longer and lengthier, deferring to what is often called 10,000 stanzas, 15,000 stanzas, 18,000 stanzas, 25,000 stanzas, 80,000 stanzas, 100,000 stanzas. And these are the volumes and volumes of elaborate commentaries. And all of them concentrated forms this particular, today what we are calling Heart Sutra, but the full title of it would be is Bhagavati Pragyan Paramit Hriday Sutra. Sanskrit term, Bhagavati, often translated by people as, because the term Bhagavati has a strong connotation of goddess or a mother principle, and therefore often Prajnaparamita is also said to be mother of all the Buddhas, and there is a form given to Prajnaparamita as a female deity. However, if you go beyond just the form, Bhagavati Sanskrit terminology itself has much more deeper sense of two words, nature and something that is a union. So the Bhagavati principle itself is union of two forces, of pristine wisdom and skillful means. And the inseparable union, the jointness, becoming the fundamental nature, therefore the term Bhagavati. Pragyana Paramita, or Prajna Paramita, as many times you all pronounce. Pragyana is, Prajna or Pragyana is, often translated wisdom. But here, Paramit, Pragyana Paramit, simply has to refer to a wisdom that is beyond the realm of conventional reality. So if you see Pragyana Paramita as something that can be within the framework of intellectual knowledge, then it has the fault of it becoming conceptual. If it becomes conceptual, then you'll have to argue whose wisdom is better than whose. Because a concept immediately is basis of argument. Whose truth is better than whose truth? My wisdom is, why can't my wisdom be better than your wisdom, or your wisdom can't be better than my wisdom? So therefore, that ultimate wisdom is something that is beyond the realm of conventional reality, conventional intellectualization. Therefore, Pragyana Paramita has much more a connotation of peak of wisdom, something that is the sort of the summit of wisdom. Then if we look at the third word, Hriday, Hridaya, as many people pronounce, Hriday simply means heart. And so it can be as direct and simple. It's just the core, or it's just the heart. Sutra, or sutra as the word itself, is a chain, or what can be called a continuum. Now if you look at the entire title, and we see Bhagavati Pragyana Paramita Hridaya Sutra, what we are referring to is a continuum of that essence or the nature that is beyond conventional reality and intellectualization. So when we say something as Arya Avalokiteshvara rested in deep samadhi, what kind of a samadhi? A samadhi of a continuum that is the very core essence that holds the nature of that, of all phenomena, that which is beyond the need and the confines and limitations of conventional reality. Hridaya Sutra, the very last two words, heart and then sutra, became the very prevalent sort of a nickname given to this very exceptional. And so the point here is, when you say something as I'm reflecting, contemplating, studying Heart Sutra, it has to be immediately understood that what you are trying to recognize is nothing dissimilar from what Avalokiteshvara was trying to see. And that is nothing other than resting in the awareness of whatever is the natural reality of self and the others. And so here, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, therefore, became the very foundation, the basis not only of Mahayana teachings, but that which then holds the very core essence of all the Buddhist teachings. And so reciting the Heart Sutra, reflecting upon the Heart Sutra, being able to remind one's own meditation, and evoking the meaning of the Heart Sutra allows one to then really walk the path of authentic Buddha Dharma. Because if that is not understood, then sadly, one becomes quite, it's quite likely that one may become trapped as well as victim of all the superficial Dharma that is very prevalent in today's times. Not because there is an intention to bring about modification and fabrication in Dharma itself, but we are very aware that Dharma is handled by people like you and I. And we invest a lot of ourselves into the path of the practices, and it's very seductive. The tendency to contort the Dharma to suit according to one's own expectation is a seduction that is very difficult to resist. And so at what point one becomes sort of caught in the trappings of superficial Dharma, just as what is happening today, has to be very carefully examined and observed. Because in the beginning, I think most people, of course, there are always some people who are sort of have nothing better to do. So then they think, oh, I should just go and become a Buddhist for a while. And that's how you sort of come into Buddhism. But with exceptions of such kinds, or some who reluctantly come because of their parents or brothers and sisters or spouses, and you're not going to get married to a partner unless the partner insists, you know, that you become a Buddhist, and therefore, so that you remain with your partner. There are so many friends of mine who have sort of grudgingly become meditators because that was the condition for getting married, placed by their partners and so forth. Now, these are some exceptions, but primarily, the point here is that most people who do search for some spiritual insight in the very beginning always come with a very authentic motivation. Even if that authentic motivation may not be very well formulated or articulated in their own mind. And in that sense, if you ask them, why are you meditating? They will say, I don't know. But even in that not being able to articulate carefully, there is a deep longing for something pure, for something good that they would like to realize and achieve. However, 5 years into it, 10 years into it, 15 years, then it gets worse and worse as you age with the Buddha Dharma. Then sort of you get sidetracked. And that very first sort of really genuine intention that was so pure that it was not even articulated somehow becomes decreased and becomes sort of seduced by the agendas that we bring into meditation. Because with age, most oftentimes, especially if one's own practice is not constantly analyzed, examined, and made sure through your own effort and through the blessings of the gurus and all the teachings that you receive, if you're not carefully observing and analyzing your own intention all the time, it's very easy for the mind to become caught in finding an ambition in the path of the practice. So from very simple ambitions that are very prevalent in the East, which is about having a good life, long life, no obstacles, health, wealth, and prosperity. This is where it all comprises within. In the West, then, it's the same, but it's a little bit different. Now, it's very sort of interesting that when I first started coming to the West, there was a group of people who constantly told me, be sure to give us Buddha Dharma, not the Tibetan culture. Because they said Tibetans were very orthodox in their approach, that they were very theistic. And what attracted the Westerners to the path of Dharma was the non-theistic approach. So very well, that's very nice. 25 years after having heard this, today I don't see that in the Westerners much at all. One can't generalize, but primarily, in my experience, what I find is, however, the gears is a little bit different. East is very orthodox and systematic in its approach, where it says health, wealth, prosperity, Buddha field, best. If not Buddha field, good life, near the teacher, next life, better chance, early start. This is sort of our list, wish list, let's say. Isn't it? West doesn't say that. And so in that regard, they're not as dogmatic or as sort of theistic. But here, today, what you've come up with is all those feelings and connections and well-being and all the goodness thing that you have, And so it's a blissed out state. So you're doing much worse than the Tibetans. We at least think about the next life, isn't it? You're just content with something that is sensorial just in this life, which doesn't even go very far into old age. It's all about now, isn't it? And so what happens is these are, East or West, are the beyond joking about it. But it's very sad. Because if you really look at the power of Dharma, which happens to be a path of cessation of suffering, not only for oneself, but for everyone, that potency of the Dharma is not tapped into, because a singular ambition that you begin to develop, a very temporary ambition that you begin to be seduced into, becomes the whole reason why you are engaging in the path of the practice. Of course, you keep saying things like liberation of all sentient beings. Where is there any Buddhist meditator who at some level doesn't want to see the cessation of suffering of every sentient being? We all do. But do take time to really go into your mind and see how convinced are you about it. So it's a good thought. Whether it happen or not, we don't know. And we don't care actually much. So long as you have a good session, so long as your mind is relaxed, that your mind is wise, so that you're able to, at the most, handle an emotional problem more sensibly, which will save your money from going to a therapist. Self-therapy. Now, what I mean to point out is, what is superficial Dharma? It's about something that is limited. Now, of course, if there's anyone who says, I am not in this to liberate others, nor am I in this to really wish enlightened for my own self. That's not a criteria for me. I would be very satisfied if I had a basic aware life that was mindful, that was able to have a sort of a foundation of happiness for myself and the others. Recently, I met one lady who said that to me, I'm not looking for enlightenment. I don't think I can do it. It's just too tough for me. All I want is just to have some happiness in my own self that can make my living happy for me and for my family and those who are relating to me. And so I thought that that was very wonderful, because there's a level of honesty in that. So those who are honest in that approach, relative approach, systematic approach, theistic approach, or a covert non-theistic, actually theistic approach. all these are very fine. And all the mushrooming of different Dhamma centers that are providing many different such methods, I appreciate that because they do it in the same way that we have Pilates classes, we have yoga classes, we have meditation classes, we have singing classes, and all those laughter classes and so forth. So those are all very good. My problem is with those. Someone like myself, who every day claim about enlightenment and cessation and understanding absolute truth, but can never really cut ties with this subterfuge attitude of holding on to a personal ambition and pretending that you don't have that ambition. And sitting in the meditation with the thought, if I don't think about it, that ambition is not there. You know, like a small child who steals a chocolate cake when the parents don't allow them, and a cake all over the face. And then the mother says, where's the cake? And the child says, I don't know. In the same way, if we observe ourselves in meditation and we work with what is truth, letting go, non-attachment, selflessness. And you and I do sit in meditation trying to work with it. But even in that moment of trying to remain in compassion that is beyond any self-cherishing agenda, it's never really distant from a certain momentum of restlessness that is very much caught in the ambition of sustaining the self. To such a degree that we can't let go of such things such as, I see the realization, I am generating compassion, compassion is difficult for me or easy for me. And so all of that which is supposed to be without the agenda of the self actually revolves around, like a satellite, around an ambition of the self. So pretty much there is an agenda of the self. That is then said to be where a meditator is not comprehending the very quintessence of the Mahayana teachings. And here, reciting the Heart Sutra allows you to bring that back into your own reflection. Traditionally, reciting the Heart Sutra as often as possible, especially in some of the traditions, such as in the Japanese, traditions, there is a wonderful practice of doing nothing but writing the Heart Sutra every day. Because in some ways, just reading, and you don't know what you're reading because you get so used to just muttering things and not really reflecting upon it. But really, as a calligrapher, and with beautiful calligraphy, writing it so that each word evokes an awareness within one's own self, whether in this way or in the various ways in many different traditions the Heart Sutra has been used, allows a meditator to not be seduced into those very superficial approaches to the Buddha Dharma, which then amounts to nothing but tremendous waste of one's own exertion, effort, and potentials. Therefore, Prajnaparamita Sutra refers again and again back to what is called the very quintessence of the Buddha Dharma, of remaining within that deep understanding of what the natural truth is. Now, if you look at, for example, various teachings within the Zen tradition, Theravadin tradition of dhyanas or jhanas as they are called, whether we see Mahayana teachings and particularly the analytical approach of the Shamatha and Vipassana in Mahayana teachings and the Madhyamika school, and then later even further elaborated as Mahamudra and Dzogchen, different kinds of training. The whole emphasis is not to do anything much beyond resting the mind in the deepened sense of awareness of what the natural truth is. Whatever is the true nature of things as they truly are, being able to absolutely recognize it, and therefore from that we come across many different anecdotes or references. Very close resembling to the Heart Sutra teachings is the Vajracchedika, or the Diamond Sutra as it is more popularly known. If you look into it, there is at the end of the text the conversation between Subhuti and Buddha Shakyamuni himself. And Subhuti is said to have struggled with trying to understand the reality of perceptions. And his constant reflection and analysis was to try and understand what is the nature of perceptible objects, what is the nature of perceiving mind, what is the relationship between perceiving mind and perceptible object or perceived objects. And so the Diamond Sutra is a conversation between the Buddha and Subhuti himself. And at the conclusion of the text is said to be the very soul of the Diamond Sutra, where after a whole afternoon of conversation, the Buddha asks Subhuti, "Have you understood?" And Subhuti says, "I have understood." And the Buddha asks, "Has the teacher taught? Have I taught today?" And Subhuti says, "No, you have not taught." And then the Buddha says, "Absolutely right. You finally have understood it." That's one reference to keep in mind. Other reference, let's see, within the Vajrayana tradition. We find, let's see, Telopa, for example, who says that ultimate abiding in the nature as is requires the meditator not to meditate, not to see, not to think, not to express, not to perceive, not to recognize, not to know, simply abide. In the Dzogchen tradition, we find Padmasambhava saying the same thing. When Yishisojel asks him, "How can you practice the Dharma authentically? And how can one be absolutely sure that one is meditating in such a way that it is not fabricated Dharma?" Then Padmasambhava says, "Don't do anything. Don't follow, don't think, don't conceptualize, don't articulate anything, don't express anything, don't do anything, nothing to see, nothing to follow, nothing to abide within, simply let be." Specifically pointing out, one is not enlightened with fabricated dharmas. One needs to be able to understand a dharma beyond fabrication. One is not ever enlightened through indicated dharma. One needs a dharma beyond indication. One is never enlightened through expressed dharma. One needs a dharma beyond expression. Here the points are that throughout the Buddhist history, all of the teachings, with all of its different methods, singularly emphasizes one thing. And that is that ultimately a meditator best understands where you are able to let go and abide within a state of absolute openness and natural ease. All of this can be probably simplified. Now, if there's anyone new here who hasn't heard all of these teachings very much, then if I were asked to simplify all that what I have spoken about in the last 15 minutes, then the simplification would be is that one doesn't, to be able to really understand the very core essence of what Buddha Dharma is trying to teach, all it is asking for you is to give yourself a break from thinking that you have to do it, that you have to see it, that you have to achieve it, that you have to change it, that you have to be able to give fruitioning to it, a sense of deepened arrogance that begins to assume that without its interference, somehow this world will not know how to function. Now, we may not think about it in that way, but if you watch our behavior pattern, so the whole, if you look at all of the Buddhist teachings and the different methods that are there, it always comes to this one single thing. Sit still. That's a nice thing. But what it's asking for you is your physical movement is not needed so much by anyone. You suppose that without your physical movement, somehow nothing will function. Try it. You know. And you'll see that others around you are happier because you're not creating so much interference in their life because you're sitting still. Most importantly, keep quiet. Silence. The time that you are silent is the best thing you can do for anyone else. Now, the instigating factor behind these two is chattering of the mind, is the mental thought. Give your mind a break and allow it to simply let free all of those suppositions that its interference and modifications are constantly needed for everything. And so the apprehension that creates a momentum of two particular things. One is discontentment, and one is restlessness. Restlessness is with the supposition that if you are not restless, you will be at loss. But because you continue to provide yourself a situation where you are constantly restless, and it doesn't actually work the way you hoped it would, it creates further discontentment. But the discontentment boomerangs back to create further interference, further restlessness. It's a constant, as a meditator, watching that constant sense of discontentment and restlessness or the anxiety, which then projects itself in the form of speedy mind, speedy speech, and speedy body, or restless speech, restless body, and restless mind. And that's what we are, is living an entire life, and where better than New York would be a good example of this restless body, restless speech, and restless mind. All in the hopes and the assumption that the restlessness is the answer to the quest for happiness, for contentment, for peace, for the fulfillment of one's wishes. And when it doesn't, then you become more insecure. And the insecurity often is sort of tried to be evaded by even inciting more restlessness of body, speech, and mind. And so where the rhythm of that is seen, then someone like Arya Avalokiteshvara begins to question that. Is that outward movement of proliferation of all the restlessness, if that is leading to a point of unceasing sort of whirlwind of activities, that itself is becoming so powerful that it drowns any kind of your own basic sanity and awareness being in control of any situation. When you are completely subsumed into that situation itself, then that is probably not the answer to the expectation and the aspiration of peace or harmony. And a questioning mind, such as that of Arya Avalokiteshvara, begins to then ponder upon what the words of the Bhagavan, the Buddha himself, were. When he presented the Buddha Dharma through his own realization, giving what is called the four seals. All phenomena are impermanent in nature. That's the first seal. All contaminated phenomena are the sources of discontentment. That's the second seal. All phenomena are devoid of inherent permanent existence or self. That's the third seal. Cessation or nirvana is utter peace. That's the fourth seal. And so when we talk about Arya Avalokiteshvara in deep reflection, what he was reflecting upon is probably through the engagement on the path of the four seals. And when the path of the four seals as reflection manifests as an awakening of what the true nature is, that is then said to be Prajnaparamita. Or in other words, when through contemplation on the four seals, the mind begins to truly understand the fundamental nature of things as they are, that they are impermanent in nature, that it is not a singular entity, supposition of it can lead to that restlessness or discontentment. Therefore, freeing oneself from these three misunderstandings can actually be a key to the understanding of genuine peace.
So when that realization or that understanding sort of unfolds itself, manifests itself within one's own understanding or realization, that realization becomes what is called samadhi. And that is the samadhi that our Arya Avalokiteshvara was in. In the Madhyamika teachings, these four seals are taught in the simple way of observance of anything. In Madhyamika, the hand is given as the example. And if you've studied Madhyamika, you've gone through this example. So when we say, in Madhyamika it says, if you look at your hand, the general supposition of a person who doesn't reflect upon the truth of the four seals, in the beginning assumes that the hand is permanent. This was the hand I had yesterday, this is the hand today, and this is the same hand I will have tomorrow. This is the hand I had when I was 25 years ago. This is the hand I had when I was 3 years ago. This is the hand I was born with. Now that's not true, is it? Hand I had, let be the born with, hand I had 25 years ago, definitely not the hand. You can see it, isn't it? And therefore, it asks meditators to reflect upon the first seal. Things that you think are permanent in nature, is it really permanent? Look at your hand and see. We're not talking about hand from a Buddhistic perspective. We're not deprecating the hand. It's not a denigration of the hand. But it's a fact, a reality, of a very gentle approach of appreciating a rather wrinkled old hand of a 50-year-old person that is not the hand of one 25 years ago. It's a sense of change. Now, this looks fine so far. Second seal would be is looking at the hand and saying, when I look at the hand and I say this is a hand, from the Madhyamikan's perspective, is that you're being very cruel. You're actually being very ungenerous. You're actually being very much like a person who takes or gives credit only where you need to flatter, but without really understanding the wholeness of a certain situation. You get very annoyed when in the offices that you work in, the credit goes to one manager or whoever it is, whereas the work has been an input of many people. And many of you get very upset and you say things like, everybody worked so hard, but then the one person is getting the credit and that's not justice and so on and so forth. And you hold the placard and go on strike. Well, you don't do so much in America, but the French probably will be the first one. They have the unions there. So in the same way, that is the same kind of analogy can be taken, is that what is not justified here, what is not true consideration, is the fact that wholesomeness has not been taken into sort of consideration here. That the credit is being given, and mainly the credit or the label of that designation is being given for only one reason. Actually, two. Two reasons. One, you don't have time to think better or more. And the two is it's the most convenient thing for you. So when you say something like, you look good, it's because you're in such a rush to articulate something so quickly. Now let's change that to you're bad. And we sort of subject that person to our opinion and judgment without really thinking carefully whether that placement of the judgment is really justified or not. Now back to the hand, if you look, Madhyamika says, hand is H-A-N-D, just four alphabets, letters of the alphabet. If you look carefully, there is no hand because either you have a thumb or an index or a middle finger, ring finger, pinky finger or the small finger here. Or you have skin or nerves or bone or tissues or muscles and joints and fluids. You have different, the front and the back part of it. And therefore, which part would you associate with being independently a hand? Or would a person not be a better, clever person who truly has time to appreciate, can say hand. We're not saying you can't say hand. You can say hand, but every time you say hand, you also in your mind develop a pervasive understanding of how many things go into the buildup of the hand. Buddhistic perspective of trying to say everything is impermanent is never a deprecation of permanency. It just is allowing you to think more openly, more pervasively, so that what you are actually saying, particularly as a Buddhist, if every day you're going to say something like, I'd like to be a kinder person, I'd like to be a compassionate person, and I ask you the question, how many of you would like to be a kinder, better, sensible person? Everyone should raise their hands, isn't it? And probably that's how you feel also. But you can never be a kinder, better, more sensible person if you do not change the outlook that you have to things. I want to be kind, but I'm too quick. It's not convenient for me to be able to look at everything more correctly. I'm going to be kind based upon what is convenient for me. They'll have to keep up with the speed that I am in. They have to know that I don't mean any harm, but I'm going to say the most hurtful things ever. They'll just have to understand that I don't mean it in that particular way. You know, we say all those kinds of sort of things. And the habit of that is born from the tendency to have a very linear perspective, with the reason being nothing other than that the linear perspective suits you. It is convenient to you. Now, when suitability and convenience to you seems to be the motto with which you subject others to your opinions, physical actions, verbal actions, and speech, then such a person has to relate to a religion to actually be kinder. Then you have to do things like lock yourself up in small shacks and cabins. We call them retreat cabins, but they're shacks and, you know, caves. And have things like gurus. And be in rooms where there are things like these. They're all very pretty, but that you have to actually sit like that. Today is what, Monday? Tuesday. Yeah. On a Tuesday evening in New York, doing this to become a better human being, there cannot be a more bigger joke on yourself than this. And you get yourself in that situation simply because of that one reason: linear perspective, inability to see things as they truly are, and more living by that speed which allows you to sustain just mere suppositions of everything. So you suppose everything. You suppose this is good. You suppose that is bad. You suppose this is right. You suppose that's wrong. You suppose he's better. You suppose this is worse. You suppose they're rich. You suppose this is poor. You suppose being in the Upper East Side is better. I don't know what the opposite is. Upper West is the opposite. Upper West is the worst. It's not. Yes. Up the hill is better, down the hill is worse. I'll stay with my own analogy, I think. You know, but there is. And all of the discriminations, all of the biases, selfishness, stinginess, aggression, division, hatred, competitiveness, jealousy, then anger, then desire, then bitter and more strong confusion, is the result from that one simple thing, linear perspective of things as they are. How do you teach a person? Is you teach that person by looking at the hand and saying, hand is impermanent. In the same way that you can say hand, but at the same time always develop a better perspective of knowing there is no one hand independent of itself. It is a coming together of all many different aspects. And so when I say I like my hand, my mind is able to actually contain a deeper appreciation of all other factors that go into this composite thing that I will temporarily label as hand. And therefore, Madhyamika says, in the same way that it is understood to be impermanent, it is understood also to be a composite, interdependent upon many different causes and conditions. And the third factor, it begins to see that there is no independent hand by itself. It is part of something. It is part of your body. It is part of your hand. It is part of your shoulder. It's part of your arms. And that it does not independently exist by its own self. It has to be seen as something that is part of your whole self. And so therefore, I think it is, I'm not so sure who, but I think it's Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche who says, anybody who goes to buy hand lotion, or if you have something called hand lotion in your home, and most of you probably have, is someone who's always assuming that the hand is independent of your body. You can't use your cold cream or whatever cream on your hand, isn't it? And therefore you have things like hand cream, lip cream, eye cream, I don't know, nose cream, cheeks cream, or whatever. That you have different things for each different thing. That is the kind of pinpointing to sort of very fine things that are real. And we are not doing this just with our hand. We are doing it with a lot of things and in every way. Now reflect upon your whole life when you begin to not understand these three fundamental things. Things are always changing. And you try to reverse that. And you live with the supposition it is not impermanent. And you sustain that supposition. Somehow you have to let that supposition be. And then on the other hand, I think if you look at the recent news, now this is very judgmental of me, but I'll still use it as an example. If you watch Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, it is, I was reading an article about him trying to prolong youth and how to do it. And so it'll be interesting. Hopefully our lives will be long enough to see how long he's going to be successful in doing this. And like him, there are many of us. Yesterday, there was a discussion in the car I was in where people were talking about average lifespan being hopefully 130 by 2025. Now, 130 is also not that long period of a time. But whatever it is, we're trying to constantly move against that change and that impermanence. And someone who really holds on to it very tightly feels the change actually more poignantly than some of the more relaxed people. For example, you just had Labor Day weekend. Now, when you're very possessive about your Labor Day weekend, then that Friday and Saturday and Sunday goes just so very quickly and changes into Monday. Whereas when you go back to the job, Friday is still Friday, Saturday is still Saturday, Sunday is still Sunday, but those are long. So our Labor Day weekend, Saturday, has 6.5 hours. And a work day or some day when you have to face some situation which you're not looking forward to, that Saturday comprises of 74 hours or 72 hours. So that's what we're talking about, is the more you hold, the more you will feel that you have to go against the current of something that is happening. That then increases. We're talking about the restlessness or the anxiety, and the anxiety and the feeling of that apprehension that is continued. And therefore, in the same way, things are not as we assume it to be. There are many factors that goes into building of things. And when we don't understand, then we do one thing, and that is blame, praise or blame. We support or we don't support a certain thing. This is called praise and blame. But the basis of our praise is incomplete in that it is born out of a linear perspective. The blame that we put in is also not justified. If you look carefully into any situation, so many things go into the birth of any circumstance that it is not really justified that a direct praise or a blame, credit or discredit, can be given the way we freely do things. And since it is not the natural nature, therefore, there is an undercurrent of dissatisfaction because of the imputations that you have brought in. Therefore, the second seal, which says contaminated phenomena is the source of discontentment. It's not for any other reason other than what in simple words would be is, it's a lot of effort to keep a lie. When you're positing all of your opinions based upon assumption, you have to be very careful that they're always the sort of the modification that you've given it, the kind of appearance you've given to it, that it is justified. And that increases the restlessness and the aggressive nature through which you continue to hold on stubbornly. And that is the buildup of the arrogance and the ego. And so therefore, again, being able to really look at the things as they are, to be able to say nothing is independent, as it seems, that it is the coming together of many different things beyond all of the things, just as a hand, beyond all of the many different hundreds of particles that are there. There is no one independent hand that you can say and label, but beyond the label itself, there is no reality of the hand itself as a separate entity. Being able to see that that same understanding is relevant to everything that we are looking at, that we are listening to, that we are able to articulate in our own minds. So therefore, when we say, this is good, beyond G-O-O-D, where is there an independent thing that is called good that you are going to hold on and insist that not only you believe it, but everybody else you relate to believe it? And the more stubbornly you posit that and you sort of insist everyone agrees with you, that's what creates animosity and competitiveness, as well as a sense of, again, assertion of the self, increase of the ego, and the arrogance. So therefore, Madhyamika say, just by reflecting upon hand or any such structure and giving deeper sense of contemplation that matures the mind into a sympathetic attitude that allows things to be impermanent, things to be composite, and things to be mere labels and beyond designation, nothing more than what its absolute nature of nothingness is or emptiness is. Seeing that carefully, being able to really not only see it. Now, if you refer to the text itself. I'm just going to read it from the beginning. In thus have I heard, Kavatuta. Thus have I heard, once the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagriha at Vulture Peak Mountain, together with a great gathering of the Sangha of monks and a great gathering of the Sangha of Bodhisattvas. At that time, the Blessed One entered the Samadhi that expresses the Dharma called profound illumination. This is then what we have been talking about. The Bodhisattva Mahasattva, while practicing the profound Prajnaparamita, saw in this way. He saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. Now, in English, there is one word missing here. However, if you look at the word yang in Tibetan, that's in brackets in the text. You see that? If you read the translation, it may also be read in this way. If you translate the word yang, then it will sound like this. At that very time as well, Holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, beheld the practice itself of the profound perfection of wisdom, and he even saw the five aggregates as empty of inherent nature. The word yang here, often translators have translated as even. Some translators have translated it as also. And in the other translations, for example, in the Naranda translation, I think they have also used the word here. While practicing, he saw the five skandhas to be also empty of nature. Most of them using the word also or even. Now, why is that word yang so very important to the Heart Sutra? Is because it reveals the process of Avalokiteshvara's insight. reflecting upon the Buddha's four seals. All compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are the sources of discontentment. All phenomena are empty of self. Being able to reflect, Nirvana is peace being the fourth one, being able to reflect in this way, then he also saw that the five skandhas are also empty in nature. So the even implies a sense of his working with the four seals, and then through that same, applying that same analysis and recognition of the nature of the five skandhas, what are called the five aggregates, or also known as the five, sort of the makeup, the five aspects that make up our individual being. So who we are today, whether it is our individual phenomena or whether it is any phenomena on the external world, the makeup, the very, very ground makeup from which everything arises, are sort of congregated into these five aspects: form, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness. These are known as five skandhas. In English, skandhas, the Sanskrit term, can only simply be read five aggregates. Now here, the Avalokiteshvara's insight. Seeing that everything is impermanent, seeing everything is composite, seeing everything does not have an independent entity, is not an independent entity, applies the same to also the five aggregates, the five skandhas. In the Madhyamika teachings, there's a very simple analogy of the five skandhas. For those of you who are new, let me just give that to you. What do we mean by the first skandha, aggregate, form? Again, take the example of your hand. Your hand touching fire, the fire and the hand are considered to be form aggregates. Feeling aggregate is said to be that subtle moment where the hand feels the fire itself. So feeling is considered to be much more the very origin of touch. Wherever eyes touch a form, when you look at something, when you hear a sound, the ear consciousness or the ear sense touches the object from where the sound is coming. That moment of touching of the sense and the sense object is considered to be the second skandha or aggregate, feeling. Perception is further elaboration of the feeling. And therefore, here it is considered, said, the analogy is given where you say the hand feeling the sensation of the heat of the fire is considered to be the perception skandha. Now, formation, the fourth skandha, is usually translated. Now, if I can find the English translation for this, reflexive, reactive response. Reflexive is something that you do without thinking, habit. Then reactive is, it's very familiar. It does it again and again and again. So it sort of cooperates with one another, the reflexive and the reactive. And the response is the response to whatever is conditioned. So formation skandha can be defined, because of its characteristic, as a very reactive, reflexive response to the things. Here, in this analogy of the hand and the fire that we're using, it's the momentum or the force or the energy that takes the hand to the fire or brings the fire to the hand, either of these two ways. That sort of a sense of coming together of both of these two is considered to be the formation skandhas. Consciousness is said to be when you say, ouch, that's consciousness. Someone who is able to keep all of these together and recognize out of it and articulate the sense, that's supposed to be the consciousness skandha. So when we talk about every one of us, animate and inanimate phenomena, the makeup is nothing other than the five aggregates. It's for you to think beyond these five aggregates. is there the possibility of anything to be? It's either form or feeling, perception, formation, or the consciousness that recognizes it. So therefore, the analysis or the analytical approach in the Mahayana tradition is to take the very sort of breakdown to the very particulars or the very core factors that become the basic makeup of every phenomena, animate and inanimate. Therefore, the skandhas are considered to be the object of analysis. And so here, therefore, he even saw the skandhas to be empty in nature, the Heart Sutra says. Then you'd have to go into the analysis of what is the nature of form. Is form permanent, or is the nature of form impermanent? That's very easy. It doesn't take a very intelligent person to know that form have, we assume the form to be permanent, but otherwise, there is no form that is not destructible. There is always an origin. There's a phase of existence. There's a phase of destruction. And there's a phase of extinction of everything. Anything that is formulated, there is a destruction. Anything that is gathered has a dispersion. Anything that comes together parts. And therefore, what is there? From the biggest of the biggest object to the minutest of the cells or atoms, what is there that can be held to be unchanging, permanent, everlasting? So from the contemplative perspective, then you have to adjust your mind to recognizing whether or not form is empty in nature, form is compositeness, and form is impermanent or not. So form is impermanent. Is any form ever possible without interdependency and coming together of many different factors? Here also, we easily find nothing is independent of one another. Everything comes into origin because of interdependency. Many things go into the makeup of any form. And therefore, form is changing. Form is a compositeness. There is no independent form that is permanent and absolute, existent, without change. In the same way, feeling. And so again, taking to meditation, what is feeling? And then feeling, of course, as the Satipatthana Sutra itself says, when it talks about the four foundations of mindfulness, it says in the text itself, just as a butcher sits on a crossroad, the Satipatthana Sutra says, just as a butcher sits at a crossroad, now in the olden times, I don't think they do it these days, but just as a butcher sits on the crossroad having butchered or slaughtered a cow or any other animal, and he sets apart all the different parts and organs of the animal and says, this is the head, this is the lung, this is the intestine, this is the hind leg, this is the good meat, this is the bad meat. In such a moment, a meditator looks at it and says, where is the goat? Or where is the cow? Or where is the buffalo? And sees that there is no buffalo other than the constituents, the coming together of all these different parts. In the same way, the Satipatthana says, when you reflect upon feelings, a feeling arises and the assumption is that it is independent, it is permanent. But even in that next fleeting moment when you look at it, it's another thought, it's another feeling. One following the other, constantly changing, one sees the impermanent nature of feeling. In the same way, if one were to search for the existence of an entity called feeling, one would never be able to actually locate one. So therefore, one can only conclude, are you simply going to stubbornly just still say it exists? It's your choice. We all do that all the time. Or is a person going to better mature one's perspective of what feelings are by knowing its own true nature? In the same way, perceptions. And you go into anyone's situation. Let's say you walked into this room today. And if Bruce got up and instead of saying the wonderful things and warmly welcoming all of you, if he had stood up and say, we are the best, you're all ignorant, You know, if you are inside, you cannot get out. You have to sign up and be a lifetime member of Rigpa. If you if he started that momentum, you would not feel as welcome, warm, or comfortable, or safe, isn't it? Perceptions are as changeable with every situation as that. It takes one person to say something that can change a happy moment to a sad moment, or for a sad moment to change into a good moment. And therefore, impermanent in nature, and absolutely dependent upon causes and conditions for it to come into origin. Formations are, again, dependent upon, as I said, since it is reflexive, reactive response, it is never independent by its own self. It is merely a moving impulse, a moving momentum, or call it an energy or a force that is not independent, not visible, never locatable, and constantly in change, constantly depending upon causes and conditions, changing, transitory in nature. Then we come to the boss, consciousness, which we often assume to be I or me. But like any boss, helpless, if there was no form, if there was no feeling, if there was no perception, if there was no formation particularly, by its own self, it doesn't amount to anything. So therefore, absolutely for any consciousness to be even recognized or have the ability to perform any activity, it is dependent upon many different factors. It does form the basis of all factors, the four other skandhas to come together. It keeps it together. It is the base from where the previous four aggregates function. But by itself, it cannot function. It's constantly dependent upon the others, therefore composite. And then if you were to locate for it, then as the texts have beautifully said, the Buddha never found it. If you can do it better, the contest has been left open by Buddhists for now 2,500 years to prove the Buddha wrong. So therefore, mind, we call it mind, consciousness, we call it consciousness, but beyond just a name, there isn't anything that can be perceptible and found as an entity called consciousness. Agreed, it is the basis, but the basis is nature itself is nothing, is emptiness. And so therefore, in the text here, it says, thereupon the Buddha's inspiration, the Venerable Shariputra, when he asked the question to Arya Avalokiteshvara, how should a noble son or a noble daughter of the family engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom? How can we practice so that we may also understand the same thing as you have understood? To that question of Shariputra, Arya Avalokiteshvara answers, where he says, when this was said, Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, now we are continuing, if you look into the text, spoke to the Venerable Shariputra and said, now I'm reading Ari's translation here, which is quite the same, but I'll just read this since it's in more prose form here. When this has been said, Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, spoke to Venerable Shariputra and said, Shariputra, any noble son or daughter who wishes to practice the perfection of wisdom should see this way. They should see insightfully, correctly, and repeatedly. These three instructions becoming the foundation of discipline in meditation. Why do we need to meditate often with the discipline, with diligence? Is because an insight glimpsed once happens but is not powerful. Certainly it is not powerful enough to cut through the suppositions and the belief of the suppositions that have been sustained over lifetimes. And therefore, in order that that understanding of impermanence, of interdependence, of emptiness requires, as Arya Avalokiteshvara sees, says, should be seen insightfully, correctly, and repeatedly. Insightfully simply refers to as it is. Correctly refers to it being free from personal ambition in meditation, and repeatedly emphasizes continuum of that awareness, the sutra aspect, as I said earlier, almost like a chain, unbroken chain of conscious awareness of what the true nature is. That repeatedly, that even the five aggregates are empty of inherent nature. Then from here, the Heart Sutra says, form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness, referring to what are called the four basic principles of Mahayana Buddhism. When one carefully, insightfully, correctly, repeatedly sees things are impermanent in nature, things are composite in nature, things are empty in nature, and refers to even the five aggregates with that same perspective, then what arises as your insight becomes seeing the true nature, that all that what is form is empty in nature. It is empty, but at the same time, it is so interdependent that the interdependency itself allows the emptiness to becoming form. Therefore, form is emptiness, reflects the fundamental nature of empty nature of all forms. Emptiness's form refers to the appreciation of interdependent origination, that all causes and conditions brought together are able to bring from nothing beautiful objects of form. All feelings can arise, all perceptions can arise, all of this what we experience can arise. It doesn't arise because it is a singular thing, but it does arise because the beauty of emptiness allows everything to come together into origination. So that's form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is nothing other than form. It's said to be expounding the logic of union of emptiness and interdependent origination. That the form allows, that the emptiness allows interdependent origination to arise according to causes and conditions. That it arises doesn't mean it displaces the empty nature, that inherently it is all, again, separate, and their own separation at the very ultimate level reveal the inherent nature of emptiness. Therefore, the third line, emptiness is nothing other than form, is said to be really presenting the logic of the union of emptiness and appearance. Form is nothing other than emptiness. The fourth is said to be a logic that says form is not contradicting emptiness, emptiness is not contradicting form. That they are not sort of contradictory to one another, they are not incompatible with one another, but that because it is emptiness, appearances are free to manifest as they wish, but that appearance, again, is naturally, inherently empty in its fundamental nature. So therefore, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness is nothing other than form, form is nothing other than emptiness. These four, according to Arya Avalokiteshvara, if understood by a meditator, and then based upon these four principles, the simple sort of the abbreviation of this would be is everything changes and nothing is existent by its own self. These are the two fundamental principles that should be derived as the very essence of these four. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is nothing other than form. Form is nothing other than emptiness. So here, Avalokiteshvara to Shariputra says, Shariputra, any noble son or daughter who wishes to practice the perfection of wisdom should see it in this way. They should see it insightfully, correctly, and repeatedly, that even the five aggregates are empty of inherent nature. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness is nothing other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. Feeling is emptiness, emptiness is feeling. Feeling is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than feeling. Perception is emptiness. Emptiness is perception. Perception is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than perception. Formation is emptiness. Emptiness is formation. Emptiness is nothing other than formation. Formation is nothing other than emptiness. And likewise, consciousness is emptiness. Emptiness is consciousness. Consciousness is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than consciousness. Therefore, in short, as the great Mahamudra and Dzogchen masters have said, stop meddling, stop interfering, stop being so opinionated that you feel that the world cannot exist without your judgments and opinions. Particularly be guarded when those opinions and judgments that you place and impose upon the others bring such an imputation in that it is always contaminated by one who is not able to see things as they truly are and judges by what you wish to see. In other words, don't be so unkind. You are responsible for having a wonderful mind that can see more thoroughly if you would only take time. And how would you give a human being more time, especially in a culture of civilization where speed is equated with cleverness, with capability, with being worthy? There's only one. Let the person sit down. Let the person quieten. Let the person be free of thoughts. And then gradually beginning to understand that the world is better off in your stillness, in your silence, and in your freeing them from your constant modifications, elaborations, expectations, particularly expectations. And when you begin to have the insight that comes from saying what you're expecting is probably most often based upon thinking differently. Linear perspective, as we talked about. Expecting things that are naturally in constant transformation to not change. And you hold on stubbornly to that. Things are not as it is, but you stubbornly insist it be as you expect it to be, as you demand it to be. And not only do you expect it constantly, but you become very angry when that expectation is not met. And when it is met, you're even more angry that it will somehow escape from you and you don't want it to happen. And then being thoroughly confused in that you think the more you insist on your expectation and in your own aggression, that it is somehow going to be the source of your happiness. Never realizing with that ignorance, with that confusion, never realizing that the more you expect, the more you are aggressive, it will turn against you. And it does turn against you. And then you sort of scratch that sore even more. And the blood oozes out. And then you blame someone for the blood coming out and you scratch some more. And that's the kind of lifestyle that we continually lead. But if that person takes time to really see what's the basis of your expectation, what's the nature of that thing that you are expecting, particularly the expecting mind. And you begin to see things that are transitory in nature should be freed from your demand that they don't change. That's bodhicitta. That's compassion. When things are a composite of so many things, you free them from your partial linear outlook. That's bodhicitta. That's kindness. Non-interference and non-elaborations and an gentle acceptance of things as they are is the perfection of absolute bodhicitta, synonymous with the realization of empty, impermanent nature of self and phenomena. Therefore, in Mahayana, emptiness realization and the realization of absolute bodhicitta are always considered to be synonymous with one another. Seeing emptiness makes you the kindest person, and the kindest person is that which allows others to be as they are without your suppositions being the sort of the basis of every demand and expectation. So when that kind of a realization arises, then as the sort of the sutra itself then says, likewise, sensation, discrimination, conditioning, and awareness are empty. In this way, Shariputra, all things are emptiness. They are without defining characteristics. They are born, they are not born, they do not cease, they are not defiled, they are not undefiled, they have no increase, they have no decrease. And so things like sensations, discrimination, it is like this, it is not like this, it has to be like this, why is it not like this? Then you begin to see how much of it actually is the play of your own mind. You're constantly projecting all the assumptions and all the suppositions, the load of expectation that things are born, load of expectation, it shouldn't be born, why is it not there, why is it there? And so how many of what you are demanding is really there, and how many of it is just the makeup of a creative, busy mind that has tremendous, unceasing opinions and expectations, not able to see what the true nature of things as they really are. And so therefore, here Arya Avalokiteshvara says to Shariputra, Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no cessation, no discrimination, no conditioning, and no awareness. There is these five. There is no form, no sensation, no discrimination, no conditioning, no awareness. Here is then simply affirming the emptiness nature of the five skandhas, or the five aggregates, as we just spoke about. A meditator, one who sees that the five skandhas truly are impermanent in nature, composite and interdependent in its origination, inherently free of being any entity that is permanent, such is then said to be the realization of the emptiness nature of the five skandhas. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. There is no form, there is no sound, no smell, no taste, no texture, no phenomena. These are then affirming the empty nature of also the six senses or the six faculties. In the same way, just as the five skandhas are reflected upon. There is no eye element, there is no form, sound, smell, taste, texture, or phenomena. And this is then the five sensory objects also seen as emptiness. No eye element, and so on, up to no mind element, and also up to no element of mental awareness. This is then said to be the empty nature, or seeing the empty nature of the sense consciousness. So the six senses, six sense objects, and the six sense consciousnesses forming the what is called seeing in meditation, Prajnaparamita meditation, the emptiness nature of the 18 dhatus, also called the 18 ayatanas, or simply the 18 senses, sense consciousness, and sense faculties, are called elements. There is no ignorance. Also, that is inherently empty in nature. In the same way, analyzing and seeing the emptiness, there is no ignorance and no elimination of ignorance, and so on, up to no aging and death, and no elimination of aging and death, is then further investigating and seeing that in the ultimate nature, even the 12 interdependent originations, or the 12 links as they are called, are empty in nature. And this is called affirming the emptiness nature of also the 12 interdependent origination. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path. There is no wisdom, no attainment, and even no non-attainment. In this sentence, the first half, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path, is said to be affirming in the ultimate nature, the emptiness nature of even the Four Noble Truths. And ultimately, no attainment and even no non-attainment, said to be the affirmation or the recognition that in the ultimate essence, there is no such thing as even samsara and nirvana or Buddhahood to obtain. That is how a Buddhist meditator should meditate. Without ambition is a very general way of actually understanding the very deep habit that we have with having an agenda. Some agendas can be as gross as Buddha fields and long life and prosperity and wealth. Some can be even more basic and simple, such as good feelings and sensations and a happy, sane life. And some can be, however, so subtle as to even imagine that enlightenment is a perceptible, conceptual state of achievement. When that fabrication comes into meditation, what you have managed is to take the absolute truth to being copyrighted by your own ego-cherishing mind that will inevitably, sooner or later, change that what is the absolute truth to being your absolute truth. Then there's no benefit at all. Whatever you are doing is mere entertainment. Some good entertainment, some partially good entertainment, but entertainment always, very relative and never the absolute. So therefore here, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no obtainment, they abide relying on the perfection of wisdom. Having no defilements in their mind, they have no fear, and passing completely beyond error, they reach nirvana. Likewise, all the Buddhas abiding in the three times, clearly and completely awakened to unexcelled, authentic, and complete awakening in dependence upon the perfection of wisdom. This paragraph is merely emphasizing the importance of undiluted, unfabricated abiding, making sure that whatever you are meditating upon is not a cozy, in the words of this great master Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who says, building a cocoon around yourself that is comfortable. That would be then merely trying to escape into a comfortable sort of a cozy nest. Being free, when one is absolutely free from any hidden agendas of the ego, should your mind just be nothing but resting in the naturalness of things as they truly are, freeing others from your interference and fabrication. Within that mind, since there is no agenda, since there is no ego-cherishing ambition, there is no fear. And therefore, that is called the indestructible Vajra mind. To say I am a Vajrayana practitioner is the recognition of this ability, brought about by different methods, but as I said in the beginning, making sure that all of the different methods, which are like the rivulets, however, must enter into the ocean of that insight that frees any elaboration of the ego-cherishing tendencies. This is then called complete awakening in dependence upon the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know the mantra of perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the precious mantra, the unexcelled mantra, the mantra equal to unequaled, the mantra that quells all suffering, is true because it is not deceptive. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed. And that mantra is known as the Heart Sutra mantra or the Prajnaparamita mantra, Tadyatha Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhiswaha. Tadyatha simply meaning, it is this. It is simply as it is. Gate means to go. Therefore, Gate Gate means go, go. Paragate means to go beyond. Go beyond what? One's own expectations. Go beyond one's own habitual tendencies of elaboration. Go beyond linear perspective. Go beyond agendas and ambitions, even spiritual nirvanic ambitions. Parasamgate, go utterly beyond to that what is bodhiswaha, or simply called perfection as it is. Therefore, when you say the mantra, Teyatha, gate gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisattva, what you're telling yourself as a meditator is, just go and rest in the nature as is, beyond the elaborations of any insecure tendencies and habits of that fabricated mind or the mind that is contaminated by its own fabrications. And therefore, reciting this mantra is said to be extremely powerful. In the verse preceding it, it says, it is the mantra of great knowledge. It is the mantra of great knowledge because that mantra and the reflection on it itself severs grasping, severs the passion with which our ambition works. And where that ambition is dissolved, aggression is dissolved, and confusion is dissolved. Since it is the mantra that has the ability to invoke freedom from passion, aggression, and ignorance, therefore it is called the mantra of great knowledge. It is also the unexcelled mantra because there is no greater mantra than this that directly takes a meditator to resting without an agenda in the most honest and the natural sphere that you can be. Up to a point where I would say it inspires you not to be lost in being a Buddhist, to being able to understand what true Buddhism is and not to stumble upon mistakenly thinking that being a Buddhist means that you understand what Buddhism is teaching you. It is also the precious mantra because it protects the mind. Its constant recitation keeps the mind on track from all the seductions of one's own habitual neuroses. It is the mantra equal to the unequaled here meaning nirvana or absolute freedom from all elaborations. Therefore, it is equal to that state of nirvana or enlightenment. And it is the mantra that quells suffering. And it is true. If you are not creating trouble, then there is no suffering. So therefore, that mantra inspires you to also bring cessation of all the habitual patterns breeding from passion, aggression, and ignorance. That passion, aggression, and ignorance that is also not there for any other reason but based upon a simple foundation of suppositions and assumption that does not have the courage or the honesty to look at things as it truly is. Therefore, such a mantra that quells all suffering is true because it is not deceptive. It is the mantra of perfection of wisdom and should be read as Teyatha Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisoha. Shariputra, a bodhisattva, a great being, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom in that way. Thereupon the Blessed One arose from that meditative concentration and he commended Arya Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being. Excellent, he said, excellent, excellent, noble child. It is just so, noble child. It is just so. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom in the manner that you have just revealed. The Tathagatas rejoice. This is what the Blessed One said. And so the Buddha only is featured in the Heart Sutra here where he simply says, that's absolutely correct. This is how it should be practiced. And thereupon, the Venerable Shariputra, the Holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, the entire assembly, along with the gods of worlds of gods and humans, Asuras and Gandharvas, all rejoiced and highly praised what the Blessed One had said. When we read this, I remember from my teachers, Chajitjana Rinpoche would always say, at the end of it, he would always say, what is seen, never pursued. What is heard, never pursued. What is smelt, but never pursued. What is tasted, but never pursued. What is thought, but never pursued. If you understand these five simple actions that you give your senses the freedom to do, one would pretty much have a much more simpler version of the Heart Sutra also realized. So I'll leave it at that. I don't know about you, but I felt like I was racing through something very quickly. So it's never a very good idea to sort of go through any such profound text with that kind of a hurriedness. But nevertheless, reading it just as the text itself, the sutra, is read, I think what I will only end with is to urge everyone to understand how profoundly fortunate everyone is to be born a human being with so much goodness, so much potential, that even in this life, if you're not able to do extraordinary things such as nirvana and enlightenment and so forth, or liberate all sentient beings, what is very accessible to you is to be able to live a sane life. That is something that you deserve, and definitely those that you are related to deserve even more. And that potential is inherent of one's own self, and to never be far from reminding yourself always that the whole point of the Dharma is to hone and make more strong that potential that you have as a human being to have a good life and to make that good life the basis of goodness for others as well. And in doing so, if we accidentally bump into such a thing called nirvana, then that's a good bargain.